Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to Powerful JRE, where today we have an engaging interview episode featuring a remarkable mixed martial artist who has made history as Spain's first UFC champion. Join us as we explore his journey from early martial arts training to the challenges of weight cutting and the intricacies of competition in the octagon. In this episode, we dive into the fascinating world of MMA, discussing the impact of weight classes and the physical toll of cutting weight on fighters. Get ready for insights that challenge conventional wisdom and stories that reveal the dedication behind the sport. Let's begin.
Nuts. I would do something with the drug test. Like, if I go to your home to make the drug test, I put you in the scale. If you walk around like 8% or 10% over your weight, I would obligate you to go in the next weight class. Just to give you an example. For example, if you're fighting at 100 kilograms, I'm going to say okay. In kilograms, and I go to your house, I do the drug test, I put you in the scale, and you weigh this 110 kilograms, I will force you to go to the next weight class.
Yeah, I think that's realistic. That makes sense. And I think that they should have more weight classes because the weight class gaps are just too large.
Oh, maybe that's an option also.
Yeah. I mean, at the lower weight classes, it's 10 pounds, which seems reasonable. But really, at the lower weight classes, you know, when you look like 125 and 135, it could easily be 5 pounds. Five pounds is reasonable. But Dana doesn't want like 12 weight classes or 12, 15, 20 weight classes like boxing has. He wants it to be like the UFC has now, but yeah. It's not enough.
I don't really know the real reason behind that, but I would love to talk to Dana and ask him this question also, because it's kind of dangerous also,
yes,
for the guys. And many times you put on a show for the people and you don't really know if they're going to make the weight.
Right. Exactly. And they're going to be compromised. I mean, there's a lot of guys who fight just deeply dehydrated from the day before. Mm. And even though they've rehydrated themselves, their brain's not rehydrated yet.
Exactly.
It's not smart. And it's also not necessary. Like, why would it would make for better fights? Why would you want someone to be physically compromised 24 hours before they're fighting? It doesn't make any sense at all.
But at the same time, the weight cut takes something out from you. That's crazy. It's like putting a dog inside the room for 20 days without any food, and you open the door and you put him in a different room with full of food. It's like the same thing. You know, when I'm cutting the weight, I'm like, I'm a different person.
Mm.
I feel that. I'm like, my mind goes different. My thought process is different. Everything is so different at that moment. I'm not so kind when I'm cutting weight.
Yeah, more focused, yeah, dialed more in.
Exactly.
Dominic Cruz says it's a good thing. He says he likes weight cutting because it gets you dialed in. He says it gets you completely dialed in for a fight.
How much he cuts?
I don't think he cuts that much.
That's why.
35.
That's why he likes it.
Ask Alex Pereira if he likes it.
Yeah.
You know, because when he was fighting at 85, he was weighing in at 85 and then fighting in the cage at 225, 226, which is crazy.
I don't know how that guy was making 185.
I don't
know. That's crazy because he's huge and he's so tall.
Well, how about Dricus du Plessis? How the fuck is he 185? That guy's huge.
Yeah,
he's
that
a guy tank.
Is huge also.
There's a lot of these guys, like, but it's very deceptive because the general public thinks that's a 185-pound man, but he's not. Dricus is probably, when he gets into the cage, he's well into the 220s. He's
exactly.
A big guy.
I don't know in what weight he walks around, but he's a huge guy also. And comes out when he was fighting in 170,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
he was big also. He was almost killing himself.
The craziest one was Anthony Rumble Johnson. Do you remember Anthony?
Yeah.
Anthony, I ran into him once in between fights, and I said, how much do you weigh? He said, 230.
Wow.
He was fighting 170.
He switched how many weight classes? He started from 170,
mm-hmm.
He went to light heavyweight, and then
yeah.
He ended up fighting in the heavyweight division.
He
right?
went to middleweight and didn't make weight. He missed weight. And lost that fight, and then he fought heavyweight outside the UFC, and then came back and fought light heavyweight in the UFC.
You know, something similar happened to me also. I started fighting in the bantamweight division.
Really?
Yeah. Before the UFC, like in Cage Warriors, when I was fighting in the Cage Warriors, I actually missed the weight also when I was fighting for the belt. I was fighting at that time in the bantamweight division. Then I keep fighting in the featherweight, and now I'm in the lightweight. I hope I don't end up fighting in the welterweight.
How old were you when you first started fighting?
In MMA, you asking, or in,
well, when did you first start martial arts?
With 4 years old, my dad put me with my brother in judo. Then we went to Georgia. We keep practicing with the Greco-Roman wrestling, and then we moved to Spain when I was 15 years old. And completely by chance, we find a gym and we started training the MMA, the mixed martial arts.
Totally by chance.
Totally by chance.
Wow. So were you a mixed martial arts fan at all?
I didn't know anything about the mixed martial arts. I didn't know anything about the BJJ, the ground game, any fucking thing.
Wow.
So we went to Spain, and we wanted to keep with the same discipline as we were doing in Georgia with the Greco-Roman wrestling, but they don't have the culture of that sport. So we were a little bit sad, you know, because we wanted that sport. My brother was really, really good on that, so... My mom was working, and he saw a man with the cauliflower ears. She went to him, and she asked him, like, what you doing? Because my kids want to do wrestling. Do you train in some gym or something? And he said, no, I'm doing the BJJ. Bring your kids, and I'm gonna show you the gym. She came to home, and my dad and my mom, they started to convince us, like, there's a gym, they are practicing like jiu-jitsu, MMA, all the sports. And I was like, but what the fuck is this? I don't know what's this. And my dad started to show me the videos of the Gracies. He told me, like, this is one of the best sports in the world right now. You are going to guys love it, this and that. And at that day, we went to the gym, and I felt in love since the first second.
Well, it's actually a great base to start out from. Starting with judo and then Greco-Roman wrestling, mm-hmm. and then going into jiu-jitsu, it's really great because you already have an established grappling base. Mm.
It's great, of course. My recommendation for everyone is if you want to have a career in MMA, you should start with wrestling. Because for me personally, because this is my personal experience, that it's much easier to learn in the future the boxing than start with boxing and learn the wrestling.
Really?
For me, yes, I think so. And I saw that in many people.
But how old were you when you first started boxing?
17 years old.
That's fairly old, like, yeah. When you think about how high level your striking is.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
But when I started, I was like, okay, I'm very good with the wrestling. I can take people down. I can control them. I have a great ground game. But what if I go to the highest competition and I find some adversities? I have to be able to fight in the striking also. So I have to develop my game in the striking. Mm. And I start from that. And I start with my brother. We were like the first people to go inside the gym and the last ones to leave it. So we were studying every day, all day, like so obsessed. We were watching like all the videos of Julio Cesar Chavez, of Canelo, all right. that. Practicing all the techniques and then putting in interaction, the sparrings and all that. And I was like finding my style, what I really like to do.
Well, it's interesting because Spain doesn't have a long history of mixed martial arts. Mm-mm. So like you are the first champion from mm-hmm. Spain in the UFC. So it's very interesting that you got in there as a young man and there wasn't really like a big established community yet.
So I was the first guy to get into the top 15, the top 10, the top 5, and then the world champion. We had a guy in Spain who fought in the UFC. I don't know if you remember him, Enrique Wasabi.
As we shift gears from the intricacies of weight classes and the challenges fighters face, let's dive into the evolving landscape of MMA competition and what it truly means to dominate in the octagon.
Visit BetterHelp.com/JRE to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/JRE. So it's not as tactical or technical.
Exactly.
It's just wild dogs.
It's just wild dogs.
I mean, that's why Michael Chandler is so popular, because he fights like a wild dog.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. You need the guys also like him.
But I would never recommend my friend to fight like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I never would recommend to someone, watch this guy and learn something.
Right. 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 Learn. Yeah. It's like, he's so entertaining, but sometimes it's best to not be as entertaining and just to be better.
Exactly.
Yeah, and shut people down.
At the same time, you don't have to be Bilal.
Right. I see what you're saying. But Bilal, I think, gets too much bad rap. Like Bilal, when he beat up Sean Brady, that was very entertaining. And Sean Brady's very good. You know, I think Bilal just does what it takes to win. And when you're in a division, and also, like, he didn't really have a background in wrestling at the level that a lot of these guys did. He had to develop that over time.
Yeah, but there are two type of champions for me. Like, there are champions who prepare themselves to win, and there are the other ones who prepare themselves to dominate.
Mm.
I prepare myself not to win because I know that I'm going to win. I want to win in fashion. I want to dominate. I want to maul people. I want people to be entertained. I want people to be like, wow, I'm happy that I spend the money this Saturday night going watch this guy. This is what I want.
Yeah. Someone was talking about that recently on Instagram. I don't remember who the coach was, but he was talking about levels of athletes. That there's people that train to compete. There's people that train to win. And then there's people that train to dominate, to be the greatest of all time.
Exactly.
And there's a different mindset. There's a never satisfied, always improving mindset that the great champions have.
All the time. Yeah. I want the people to be entertained all the time. Like, when actually I started with the MMA, I was like recording myself all the sparrings. And after that, I was rewatching my sparring. I was like, would I pay my money to watch this? What do I have to change in my game to be more entertained?
Mm.
And this is how I was like looking myself all the time. I was very critical with myself. And this is how I develop and develop and develop. And all the time I go inside the octagon, I don't go there just to win. You know what I mean? I want everyone to be like, wow, what he just did.
Mm.
How he did it. He was the greatest of all time, and he made him look easy.
Yeah.
This is what I want. I want to change the game, you know, the people to I want you to say, your friend, watch this guy and learn something.
Mm. Yeah. Well, mission accomplished. So far, you're right? So far, so good. And now a new journey into the lightweight division. You know, I don't understand why they won't just book you and Islam. There's many times that I wish I was running the UFC. I would change so many different things. That would be one of the first things I would change. I'm like, book that fight. Book that fight right away.
You would do sound fights also in Mars, I'm sure.
I would probably.
We all go with the starship.
I got some wacky ideas. I don't even think they should fight in a cage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the cage is an unnecessary. I think it's an unnecessary element in fighting, like to push someone against something or to be able to get up from something. Oh, I don't think it's necessary.
And how
I think
you
should be in like a basketball court, that's matted up. Okay. Have a big space. Have a warning track where you can't. If you go outside the warning track too many times, you could lose points.
Okay.
And so when someone takes you down, you have to actually get up. I also think at the end of a round, like say if you got a guy mounted at the end of the round, you start the next round mounted on him.
Of course.
Yeah, I don't think.
Of course.
Because why would you give him the advantage of getting up when he never got up? Exactly. He never got up.
Never got
up. You have to earn a get up. You have to stand up by yourself.
I love it. I never thought about that, actually.
No stand-ups ever. Ever. No stand-ups. Unless someone commits a foul. Like, if someone commits a foul and you want to stand them up and take a point away, that's fine. But if the guy's in the bottom and he commits a foul, like if a guy's in the bottom, he gouges someone's eyes on purpose, take a point away, put him right back in the same spot.
Wow.
Because that's otherwise, great. Like, say if you're fighting a guy like Alex Pereira, who's never taking anybody down. Mm-hmm. He's just going to strike with you, right?
Okay.
Why would you let him back up again and have the advantage of him standing up again?
Yeah.
The beginning of the round, he starts standing up again. Now you got to take him down again.
But also, you don't think that it's a part of the show?
It is a part of the show, but I don't give a fuck about that.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. I mean, I'm a hardcore fan. I'm a purist. I think it should be about fighting, about elite fighting. And elite fighting is you got to get up. Like, if a wrestler takes you down and he just does this to you, and it's not entertaining. But if he can do that to you, that's tough shit. That's what he did.
You would change also the time range? Like, oh, you would leave a 3 rounds or 5 minutes with 1 minute rest?
The good thing about 5 minute rounds is it's sustainable and guys can fight at a high pace. If you had, like, just 15 minute round, mm-hmm. guys would be exhausted. And the end of it would be sloppy. It wouldn't be the same. The pace would be much slower. It wouldn't be as good. Mm-hmm. So I think there's nothing wrong with rounds, but I think it's one fight. It's not five fights. So why does he stand up at the end of every round? I think if a guy takes you down and he's got you mounted with, like, trapped an arm and he's punching your ribs trying to secure an arm triangle, why does he get to stand up again?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any
sense.
That's
true.
Especially if he's a striker and you wasted all that energy getting him to the ground and you got so close to cinching up a submission and then all of a sudden he's back on his feet again.
And then clink, you have to stand up.
And he didn't even earn it. Yeah. Start him right back down there.
That's true.
No cage, no stand-ups. No stand-ups ever. If everybody boos, tough shit. Go watch baseball. Go watch something else.
you wouldn't like to see at some point the world championships in mixed martial arts? Like, for example, let's say the 7 best fighters from the United States in every weight class against 7 best fighters from, I don't know, from China or from Russia.
Yeah, I would love that.
Like, the best flyweight against the best flyweight from the United States.
Sure.
And you do that, and you have 7 fights because you have 7 weight divisions. And if you win 4 weight divisions, that country won.
Mm, yeah.
That would be fun also.
That would be great. That's a great idea. I love that idea. Yeah, I think that idea sounds really good. And also, there is a bit of an issue, right, with the UFC being the premier organization for martial arts. The UFC is like, if you're not a champion in the UFC, no one thinks of you as a world champion.
Yeah.
Like, you're a world champion.
Yeah.
World champion. Someone can fight in the PFL and they could say, oh, it's the PFL world champion. Yeah. Everybody's like, right.
Yeah.
Come on.
Because at
great
the end
fighters,
of the day,
but at the end of the day,
you know that you have all the best fighters,
right?
The best collection of fighters in the UFC.
Yes. But I watch ONE FC and I watch some of those fucking animals that they have over there and I'm like, Jesus Christ, these guys are good, man.
Yeah.
Some of these guys are good. And you know, they're calling them ONE FC world champions. I'm like, I'd like to see him. I'd like to see him because some guys look real good until they fight elite talent. And we've seen that before. Like, some guys look like destroyers, and then they get in the UFC against guys who are just a little bit more technical, a little smarter, and they get pieced up.
What happens is that I think that in ONE championship, most of the time, you used to fight with strikers. In the UFC, you don't know who you're going to face next. Maybe he's a wrestler.
Right.
Maybe you're going to fight Demian Maia.
Right.
Who wants to fight you in the ground. Maybe you fight Alex Pereira.
As we shift gears from the intensity of fight strategies and champion mindsets, let's dive into some of the more personal stories and challenges faced by fighters outside the octagon.
Of course. You can't even talk to the kids about something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, like, I heard so many crazy things about that topic that...
I know.
Let's
leave it right there. We'll just get in trouble. Yeah, I mean, kill them all. That's how I feel. Kill them all. Anybody wants to do that to children? There's no reason for them to exist. You're just going to ruin lives, and not just their lives, but you're going to ruin all the people whose lives they ruin because they're all fucked up now. You know, you kill so much potential from a human being to do that to a baby. It's just insane.
Wow.
It's just fucking insane. So that's unfortunately the story with Kane right now. And, you know, he was out for a while. And once they let him out, he was coaching at AKA. And, you know, he's an amazing coach. And
we hope that they're gonna think it again and they're going to give him the freedom he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, I hope Trump pardons him. I mean, that's what I really hope.
I hope
Dana
so too.
Make something happen with that. Maybe that's possible. I mean, that might be the best option. But anyway, in his prime, Cain Velasquez versus Fedor. That's my biggest regret, a fight that we never got to see. Because when Cain, when Fedor was fighting in Pride, you know, and this is before the UFC was really huge, right? Because they were huge in Japan in like 2001, 2002. They were filling stadiums in Japan. When the UFC was just sort of emerging in the United States, it really hadn't hit its peak until 2005.
And why do you think that they never bring him to the UFC?
Well, they tried.
Yeah.
But I got to be careful how I say this. So Fedor was controlled by some Russian people that were rough men,
okay,
as it were, you know, gangster type characters, and they had a bunch of negotiations with the UFC, but there were very unreasonable demands. Like they wanted part of the promotion, they wanted to own a piece of everything. They wanted a lot because they knew that with Fedor they had their golden ticket, and they wanted to play it out as much as possible.
Okay,
and negotiations were very intense and very. Very confrontational. They got bad. Where Dana had to up his security. It got pretty,
yeah.
Yeah, it got heavy. Yeah, this is dangerous people. These were dangerous people. It got yeah. I can tell you more off air. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that story.
I'll tell you more off air. It got. You should talk to Dana about it. It got crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
They're rough
dudes. That's why.
Yeah.
Because I always thought, like, why they don't bring that guy to the UFC? Because it's going to be so fun for the fans.
They wanted to co-promote. They wanted to be a part of the promotion. They wanted more than they deserved. They didn't just want Fedor to get paid. They wanted to get paid. They wanted to make a lot of money. And they wanted to get their hooks into the UFC.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Russian gangsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get it.
Crazy
from their perspective
how they rule, like everything.
Well, Pride was run by the Yakuza, you know. So it was Japanese gangsters and Russian gangsters. They speak the same language, you know. It was, they got along fine, but then when they came over to the UFC, the UFC was like, "That's not
this
how
is not
we
the place.
Do it over here." Yeah. No, we'll give them a lot of money. Yeah. We want them to fight in the UFC, and it never took place, unfortunately.
Wow.
Yeah.
So crazy.
Yeah, so he's about to fight again. Fedor's going to fight bare knuckle.
Yeah, I heard something about that.
Yeah, I think Conor's promotion. I think it's Conor's promotion, that BKFD.
Actually, do you think he's going to come back, Conor?
If I had a bet? No.
Yeah. No,
no I don't
Why?
Think he comes back. Because he hasn't come back yet, and he could have. You know, if he really wanted to, he would have been back in the gym, had a fight scheduled, drug tested, clean, training, gone through a camp, had a fight. Like, he had a broken toe before the first fight with Chandler. I understand that. Okay. Why should you fight on a broken toe, especially a guy who moves a lot like Conor? He relies on movement so much. Yeah, I get it. So heal that toe up. What's that? That's 2 months. Broken toe's 2 months.
Yeah.
And so then you're back in camp. And then you reschedule a fight, and then you fight again. But he didn't. And also, partying, constant partying, all these legal problems that he has. You know, scooting around on yachts and, you know, driving around a Lamborghini. He's wealthy.
He's done.
Maybe. I mean, what's really sad is if he comes back when he's like 39 or 40 and his body just doesn't have it anymore, you know?
So right now he actually has a great opponent, Mike Chandler. He could fight him.
Right. Right. They could fight right now, yeah.
They could fight. Because if they put him against Paddy, I think Paddy beats him easy now.
Well,
you don't
a
think
lot
so?
Of years off, right? A lot of years off. You know, on the feet, Conor's a motherfucker.
No, in the feet, he's a motherfucker. I know that. He can knock out, like, everyone.
If he's still the same guy.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's 36 now, you know? Mm. And if he's natural, also, reality. Okay, when he breaks his leg, he gets off the drug testing, right? Because he's got to do something to heal his leg quicker. So what is he going to do? Well, you're going to take steroids. So if you're going to take steroids and you're already 34-ish, your endocrine system gets fucked up by taking steroids where your body stops producing testosterone.
Okay.
So I've had explained it to me by scientists before. And essentially, say if you take steroids for 6 months, you need at least 6 months before your body starts producing testosterone at a normal level again.
Okay.
Some people think it's twice as long. So that would be a year of no steroids before your body regains its natural testosterone levels. If it does, Depending, if it does.
You think that if someone puts steroids in his body, he never comes back as his normal body?
Vitor Belfort is the best example of this, right? He's the best guy that we could use as an example.
But he took a bunch of steroids.
He took steroids. Luke Rockhold said when he was weighing in, when he fought him, he said, "This guy's got muscles on his fucking teeth."
Yeah, on his mouth. Exactly, bro.
He was shredded. But if you go back to Vitor when he fought Anderson Silva, before they had testosterone use exemptions, he didn't look like that at all.
No, he looked old, actually. He looked like his body was relaxed.
Soft. Yeah, because like Vitor, this. Yeah. So this is the difference.
Wow.
Before you saw it and after you saw it. I mean, that is a crazy example. Mm. So when he fought Chris Weidman, his body looked soft and like his muscles look empty. They just didn't look the same. And that was just a couple of years after they fucked up with the testosterone use exemption. Because what they did was they would test guys, and if you're low on testosterone, you can have a testosterone use exemption. But you could get low on testosterone in a night if you wanted to. All you'd have to do is eat a bunch of shitty food and drink and stay up all night, and your body's natural levels of testosterone would be low. So you could go get drug. You, who has normal healthy levels of testosterone, you could wreck your body on purpose, then go get drug tested, and they say, Ilya, you have low testosterone. I'm going to prescribe to you testosterone exemption. And so then you go and take testosterone, and you become a fucking animal. and you're healthy. You don't need it. So there was a lot of guys that were taking it that didn't need it.
So you think that at this point there are guys in the UFC that are taking like steroids, let's say steroids?
I would imagine there's for sure someone doing something they're not supposed to do. Yeah.
Wow. I don't know, because at this point I feel that they are so strict with the...
They are so strict. There's a lot of guys that do their camps in faraway lands. And I think that, like, people always used to joke around about Dagestan. You know, like, try getting a USADA guy into Dagestan. You know? The moment he lands,
everybody's going to call everybody. Drug test in Dagestan. They test Khabib, for example, in Dagestan now.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure they must have.
As we shift gears from the intense discussions about fighters and their journeys, let's dive into the intricacies of technique and strategy that define success in the ring.
So, yeah, one thing is what you know, and the other is what you do with what you know.
How do you know how much time to allocate to each specific discipline? Because something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it's a never-ending journey.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many techniques. There's so many different combinations of things that you could do to a human body when you're grappling.
So the thing about me is, like, you have to decide what kind of style do you want to have. Do you want to fight from the guard? How do you say that?
Guard.
Guard?
Yeah.
You want to pass the guard? Like, there are different styles, right?
Right.
But at some point, I was fighting all the time from the guard. I was doing like the beating bolos, baby bolos, everything, because I needed to feel what the people feels when I'm passing the guard.
Mm-hmm.
The guard.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? So the same thing with boxing, for example. Someone has a defensive style, someone has aggressive style, but from distance, someone needs to cut the distance and work more in the body. So I don't know. It's like... it's so difficult to explain to you.
I know what you're saying, though. I think one of your most impressive performances was Josh Emmett. Because Josh Emmett, he's such a powerful puncher. He's such a dangerous puncher. But everything he throws you has murder on it. Everything. But you just kind of slipped and moved with everything and just systematically broke him down. But you adjusted your style for his danger. You adjusted your style for him and just... dominated the fight. I think that was one of the most impressive performances because it showed how skillful you could be. Whereas, like, imagine if Michael Chandler fought Josh Emmett. It would be fucking madness.
Yeah.
Just madness. Two dudes just trying to murder each other. Just fucking throwing haymakers. You know, but what you did was you broke down what he was doing. You found your openings. You started to get your timing. You started to figure out. You put all his movements into your computer. And then you rolled with everything. everything he threw, you rolled with. When he had big shots, you moved with them.
All his big shots were coming with the right hand. Like, he's the type of guy that ends up every combination with the right hand. So everything I had to do, it's all the time, I didn't have to exchange the punches with him. I had to let him throw me all the punches, roll his right hand, and then start with my combinations. And this is what I really did. Like, I was hurting him with the calf kicks. Then I was going for my combinations and long combinations all the time. In MMA, no one works the long combinations, no one. They always used to do 1-2, 1-2-3, but no one does 1-2-3, 3-4-5-6. You know? And
like the Jai Herbert fight.
Exactly. Yeah. Usually, you're getting two punches, everyone blocks two punches, but after the second one, they put their hands down again. And then is when I go again, like 1-2, 1-2, 3-4, 5, boom.
Mm.
You are not waiting for that. And if I change the levels and I go in the head and the body, calf kicks, I go for the takedowns, I mix it up, you get crazy.
It's interesting that you didn't start boxing until you were 17, because you're probably the best boxer in not just the featherweight division, but you might be the best boxer in the sport in terms of your movement and then your one-punch power. Your one-punch power is pretty fucking crazy, which I think you either have or you definitely can develop it, and it definitely is dependent upon technique, but either you have power or you don't have power. So did you always notice that, like from the very beginning when you first started training?
I always had power.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is.
It's a God-given thing.
God-given thing, 100%. I always had that power. I remember myself without much technique, but I was connecting the punches and putting guys to sleep in the trainings.
Mm.
And I wasn't that skillful guy, but I had that power.
But you were smart enough. See, this is the difference between like a Josh Emmett approach and your approach. You were smart enough to realize that, okay, I've got this power, but now I need to develop laser sharp technique.
Of course. And I have to be able to find the moment. I don't have to just throw it and believe that I have the power. If I connect it, I put you to sleep. No, it's not if I'm going to connect you that punch. I'm going to work for that, and I'm going to find that specific moment to put your lights out. And I know with everyone, even if in 155, I know that I'm going to be able to find that moment where I'm going to be able to connect that one punch or two or three punches. Because sometimes it's not only one. I'm able to combine punches. You know, sometimes you think that I'm going for your head and I'm going, my main combination is to go to the body. And I go to that with that liver shot. And that hurts also.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And little by little, maybe I don't knock you out, but it takes a lot of cardio from you, a lot of movements. You start doubting yourself. You're getting like, wow.
Yeah.
If he connects me this punch in the chin, I'm done. And you're starting to doubt, and then the doubts kill you at the end.
Yeah,
and it's like little by little.
Yeah, it's interesting how few guys really work the body well. That's one thing about Jack Della Maddalena, is that he's a very good body puncher, which is one of the things that I think is very interesting about this fight with Bilal Muhammad. He's a dangerous body puncher. He's very good at mixing up and down.
No one usually used to attack the body in the UFC. I don't know why. It's such a beautiful technique to go and work the body, not only the head. Everyone goes for the head.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also weaknesses in a human being's body, which is the body.
Especially with those little MMA gloves. You know,
everything hurts.
Yeah, and you're digging into that rib cage. But it's interesting how the sport evolves. And I think when a guy like you comes around that does mix things up so well and does have elite boxing, the next generation will also copy you. They will copy your style. You know, because like, think about the calf kick. There was no calf kicks forever.
Yeah. I don't know when they started with the calf kicks.
Benson Henderson. He was the first guy I ever saw do them. He was doing a lot, and I remember pointing it out. Like, he wasn't doing it as effectively, where he was like crippling guys' movement, but he was doing it a lot. And then I remember when Dustin Poirier fought Jim Miller. Jim Miller almost took him out with calf kicks. Like, wow. Dustin Poirier's calf was destroyed in that fight. And then, you know, Dustin Poirier became a really good calf kicker after that. And then it became ubiquitous. Everybody has to have a calf kick.
But it comes from Muay Thai. It comes from kickboxing. It comes from...
Well, it sort of does. But in Muay Thai, they don't throw it very often. It's not a common technique in kickboxing or Muay Thai, which is interesting. It's not as common as it is in MMA.
It hurts so much. It's like a jab, but for the legs. It's a jab.
Well, it also cripples your movement, which is terrible because you can't punch as hard because you don't have a left leg anymore or a right leg, depending on what's forward.
And at the same time, it distracts you a lot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It hurts so much.
Yeah, it hurts. Yeah. It distracts you. You have to. You don't only have to think about the hands. You have to think about also about the kicks.
Well, Izzy said that when he lost to Alex Pereira, the first fight in the UFC, he said he wasn't hurt that bad with the punches. He said he couldn't move. He said his leg was so destroyed. He said my left leg was so compromised I couldn't move. And then in the second fight, when he knocked Alex out in the first round, he said my leg was fucked already. He's like, he was getting me again. He's so sneaky with that calf kick because he throws it. He's got that weird style. Where he stands, and he just kind of throws it out there, and you don't even see it coming because he's not twisting his hips. He's not, and it's still he hits so hard that he doesn't have to turn his body weight into it,
and
he's still fucking you up.
And at the same time, he had that muscle memory.
As we delve deeper into the intricacies of the sport, let's shift our focus to the often unpredictable world of judging and how it shapes the outcomes we see in the octagon.
The judges are all established by the athletic commissions.
Yeah.
So sometimes you get great judging, and it's like, oh, the judges are good tonight. These are good decisions. And sometimes you get, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
Sometimes judges are horrible.
Horrible.
Doesn't make any sense.
You never know if they give you more points for wrestling, for striking, for defending.
Right.
It's crazy.
Well, some judges just aren't qualified. Right? They don't have a martial arts experience. They don't have a background. You know, they just learned how to judge. That you can't, but I don't think you can do that. It's like, I don't speak Spanish, but if you taught me some Spanish and then I was judging Spanish, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, crazy.
I'm not qualified, crazy. Right?
You are not.
Right. So if you have a guy who doesn't really understand who's got the dominant position, like maybe you see a bullshit guillotine that has no chance.
It's not like they never fought. It's they not even never trained.
Right. Exactly.
Most of them.
I remember
that's the problem.
Early on in the UFC, one of the judges turned to one of the people next to this person. It was a woman. She turns to this person and goes, what is he doing?
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, what is he doing? Someone was trying to get a kimura. She's like, what is he doing? She didn't know what a kimura was.
So how'd they get there?
They were boxing judges. So the boxing judges, they started using them for MMA fights with no martial arts experience at all.
Crazy.
Never stepped on the mat, never put in a mouthpiece, never got
that?
Punched in the face.
<What he's doing>?
That's crazy.
That's crazy. They don't know how it works.
And it's they're judging at a professional world championship level.
At the highest level.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
I think they should have more judges.
Let me ask you something. What do you think was the key of success of the UFC? Like, it was Dana White, it was the matchmakers, it was the fighters, it was the promotion. What it was.
I think the big thing was The Ultimate Fighter. I think everybody kind of agrees with that. The Ultimate Fighter reality show, what made the UFC huge was that first season of the reality show, because this was 2005. So reality shows were really popular back then. This is, you know, Survivor and Fear Factor, and there's all these reality shows and Big Brother. And so they had this reality show that people were watching with fighters, and then they have the finale. And in the finale, Forrest Griffin fights Stephen Bonner, and it's such a crazy fight that people are just telling their friends. The ratings were going up as the fight went on. And, you know, the Fertittas, the people that owned the UFC before this current company, they were in the hole, $40 million. And they just kept losing money, and they said, listen, this is the last. They were going to sell the UFC at one point in time. And then they got to this point where they're like, look, let's just try this one more thing. Let's just try this one more thing. And they did this reality show. And the reality show worked. And then 2005, and then they had Chuck Liddell. And Chuck Liddell was the perfect poster boy for this new cage fighting thing. This fucking maniac with a mohawk and a tattoo on his head, and he's just crushing everybody. You know, he was the perfect guy because the fights were so exciting. And he had this insane style. This insane, almost like Michael Chandler style, but
entertaining
better.
Style.
Very, very entertaining. Just warrior.
He was a good boxer.
Good striker.
Fast hands.
Yeah, fast hands, vicious knockout power. And he was a wrestler, but he didn't wrestle anybody.
And he was a heavyweight.
Light heavyweight, yeah. Big guy.
Yeah, he was a
light heavyweight. Big guy, KOs people with one punch. And, you know, it was perfect for the sport. Because, like, he was so exciting, and he looked the part. He was like a maniac. And after we'd win, he'd go, and run around the cage. It was so exciting.
Fun. So exciting.
He was the poster boy. He was the guy. He was the guy that put the sport on the map, because people would watch him, and they'd go, Jesus.
Yeah, that, timeline of MMA was so fun.
It was
with Rampage Jackson also.
Oh, yeah. And then when Rampage KO'd him, you know, he became the man, and... You know, and then John Jones comes along, and whew, you know, it's like the sport. That's what's crazy about John, right? John has been dominant now for like, what, 15, 16 years?
Yeah.
That's nuts, man.
That's why I say he's the best.
He's the GOAT. He's the GOAT.
I don't know how they don't put him as the number one pound for pound. He's the number one pound for pound.
You know, it's just because he doesn't fight as often as Islam. You know, Islam's defended his title more recently, more often against top flight competition, whereas John takes a year off, does a year off here, a year off there. But when you look at the overall record, the overall career, he's the greatest of all time. But when I talk about, like, just technique, you gotta think about Mighty Mouse too, man. Mighty Mouse in his prime was a bad motherfucker, man. He would do shit to guys like when he suplexed Ray Borg and caught him with an armbar in the middle of the air and finished him. You don't think so? I see your face. I see your face.
No. It's not like, I don't know. I never was a big fan of him.
No?
No. Never.
I think in
first
his prime,
of all, when you call yourself a Mickey Mouse.
Mighty Mouse.
So I always thought that he was a Mickey Mouse. And I'm like, bro, how the fuck are you calling yourself a Mickey Mouse?
No.
He was a good fighter. He was a very technical fighter. He dominated the whole division. How many times he defended his belt?
Like many times.
14 times?
Many times. 12? He fucked a lot of people up. But then there's an issue where the quality of the competition in the 125-pound division back then was not at the level that it is now. Like Pantoja, he's a bad motherfucker. I would have loved to see Alexandre Pantoja versus Mighty Mouse in their prime. Pantoja's a fucking animal, man. That guy's a fucking animal.
There's a guy coming up in 125. He fought in the last pay-per-view in London. His last name is Kavana in 125. He's going to be a problem in that division. He is a very skillful fighter.
Well, I think like all weight classes, now you have the best fighters of all time. Because we see guys from the Dana White Contender Series now that are coming along that enter into the UFC for their first fight. And you see these guys like, Jesus Christ, this guy looks like he has 15 pro fights in the UFC. They look elite, you know?
That's a cool program also, the Dana White Contender Series.
Oh, it's incredible.
That's something cool because they have some story behind them before they get to the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. And actually, they make a good matchmaking also for that fight.
I
like to see sometimes Dana White Contender Series over than some fight nights.
Yeah, you get to see guys. Well, that's where we found Sugar Sean O'Malley. You get to see guys. I prefer that to the Ultimate Fighter because I don't want to watch all the in-the-house bullshit and all the games that they play. I don't care about all that. I don't care. I just want to see him fight.
Not anymore. But before it was very entertaining.
In the beginning, in the early days. But now they're on like season 2000. Like, who fucking? There's been so many seasons. Like, I can't even keep track. I forget who won.
Yeah,
you know, there's so many seasons.
True also.
But my point is that the caliber of new guys when they're just entering the, like Mauricio Rufi, perfect example.
Yeah.
You see this guy, first fight
in
the UFC.
In lightweight, right?
Yeah. He's fucking huge. You see this guy first fight in the UFC, you're like, whoa, this guy is elite already. You know, same thing with Jean Silva, elite already. Like these guys, they're entering into the sport at a very, Carlos Prates, same thing. Like right away, like you're seeing like a very high level right away. And I just think that because there's so many guys like you to watch, there's so many guys like, you know, Khamzat and all these people, you get to see elite talent so these young fighters that are coming up, they have a higher level
than
to,
before.
They yeah, a higher level to aspire to.
That's true. Now, like the sport is growing, the talents are better than before.
Yeah,
because the sport has developed so much that right now you have so much experience, you can learn so much about the game. Like even in YouTube, you go on YouTube, you can learn everything by yourself.
I think in the future, guys like you will be everywhere.
As we shift gears from the intricacies of judging in MMA, let's explore how the perception of fighting is evolving and gaining acceptance in places where it was once frowned upon.
It's not only fighting. It's more than that. I don't know. I love that.
Yeah.
Most of the people before, they used to see fighting as something very violent in Spain. They hate it. Right now, it's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're starting to love that. And I saw that since the day I started, because I used to say to the people like 10 years ago in Spain, what you doing? I'm fighting. Ah, don't do that. Start learning something. Start studying. I'm like, I'm studying. Everyone chooses a career in his life. Someone wants to be a doctor. Someone wants to be a constructor. Yeah. Someone wants to be this or that. I want to be a fighter.
Yeah.
And I have to learn to be a fighter also.
But by your example, by being a true champion and by living the way you live and by performing the way you perform, you will change people's opinions. And they will see it and they will say, oh, this is different. This is not what I thought it was. This is something special.
I hope so.
For sure, brother. For sure.
Man,
it's in the cards. Well, listen, my friend, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate you very much. I'm a big fan. And I can't wait to see you inside the Octagon again. And all the best.
Joe, thank you very much, brother. That's been a big pleasure for me to be here.
Thank you very much. All right.
Bye. That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website www.podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.